The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees. Tim is off this week. So I hope you had a really good holiday and you're ready for the new cycling season. Before we begin this week's show, I'd like to say a few words about the past week and the real and serious need we have for some order out of the chaos that seems to be wreaking havoc on our streets. Without going into the sad and shocking details of the several nasty incidents that occurred, I would like to encourage all of you to think seriously about what you can do to help educate those around us who seem only to find anger and upset with cyclists on the road. The loss of so many riders this past year due to distracted, intoxicated, or just pissed off people is not acceptable. We don't really want a tipping point of loss to make the need for change. Instead, we just need to find a way to change things right now. I had an idea that perhaps it's a numbers game and that something like a ride on Washington or enough people coming from every state to one place would bring enough public attention to attract what we really need to affect change, and that is the media. It seems that when the media becomes involved, people pay attention. So I have begun the process of reaching out to those people I know in Washington and around the country who might get on board in an effort to bring our issues to the forefront. If you have any ideas, contact me. Let me know. I want to see change. I want to see it this year. Okay, I'm stepping down off my soapbox, but don't forget that 2015 might be the year that we can get something changed about how motorists and cyclists can get along better. So let's just talk about our first show for this year. I wanted to look both forward and backward. There were a lot of interesting stories in 2014, some sad, some joyous, and some downright funny. Just one example, and perhaps one of my favorites, had to be Andrew Talansky's heroic finish in Stage 11 of the Tour de France, only to abandon the following day. I also reveled in the release of so many movies and books about cycling that enriched my personal knowledge and filled many hours of our show. As you know, we began our fifth season of The Outspoken Cyclist last September, and I look forward to another great year of interviews, reviews, stories, and banter. So to begin the year, I decided to go back to my beginnings and the beginnings of The Outspoken Cyclist. Back in 1975, my very first exposure to the custom bicycle business was a beautiful steel touring frame set built by Ben Cerrata. And on September 4th, 2010, my very first interview on the show was with Ben Cerrata. Well, tonight we're going to go back to those roots and catch up with this legendary and iconic frame builder as he begins a new phase of his career. We're going to wrap up 2014 with journalist and commentator Dan Wuori. His At the Back column in Velo News about Robin Williams was recently named as one of the top stories of 2014. And Dan will share that along with some of his reminiscences about the bygone year, as well as what he sees coming up in 2015 and what his projects are. I have a few interesting news items if we have the time. Let's mosey on down to the Carolinas and unravel the 2014 cycling season with Dan Wuori. Dan, thanks for joining me on the show. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Diane. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
It is my pleasure. I wanted to bring you back so you can help wrap up the 2014 cycling season and get us sort of primed for 2015.
It has been quite a year.
Yes, it has. You actually sort of won an accolade this past week. You're at the backstory about Robin Williams was named as one of the top stories for the year by Velo News.
Yeah, that was really very, very flattering. It was very nice. They counted down the top 14 stories as voted upon, and yeah, I think it was in the top five or six. So it was a really nice honor.
And it was a nice article. So tell us a bit about your knowledge of Robin Williams. And I wanted to start with him because I think most of my listeners probably know he was a cyclist. But boy, you really brought some information in that article that I don't think a lot of people knew.
Yeah, you know, his death to me, and I'm sure to millions of others, was definitely one of the low points of 2014. You know, so many people know him, Diane, as a comedian and as an incredible movie star. I mean, if you think about the body of that guy's work, just the number of movies over the years that he made that were so amazing, it's really pretty breathtaking. But, you know, within the cycling community, he was known very differently, and that is really as one of us. I mean, he was a very avid cyclist, Robin Williams. He not only as a fan of the professional sport, but as a cyclist himself, was known to be out anytime he had a movie, he had a bike on set, and just really loved to ride. But you know, it is something that in doing a little bit of research on that piece, really came to find that he took up cycling as a way of kind of saving his life in a different way. In the early 80s, you may be aware that he struggled along with many others with a cocaine addiction, and was actually a very close friend of John Belushi's, the comedian from Saturday Night Live. And Williams was actually one of the last people to see John Belushi alive. He visited Belushi at the Chateau Marmont in Hollywood really the night that Belushi passed away, and found him too drug-addled to hang out with that night, and left. And it was the last time that Robin had a chance to see his friend, and that anyone else did. He passed away several hours later, and so that was a real wake-up call to Robin, and he took up cycling really kind of right thereafter, and joked about it being that cycling was a less expensive addiction than cocaine. He had more than 100 bikes here at the time of his most recent divorce, when that had to be inventoried. I actually spoke to Tony Tom, who you might know of. He runs an amazing bike shop in Sausalito, California, called Bicycle Odyssey, and was a good friend of Robin's, and actually was called in to do the inventorying of his bikes at the time of that divorce. So Tony not only sold him a number of those bikes, but had an insight as to just how many he accumulated over the years. It was a very big part of his life. The other thing that very much resonated with me personally was that he acknowledged that he used his writing as a treatment for his own depression, which I, along with many others I know, have struggled with from time to time. And one of the things, Diane, that really resonated with me, because this is very true of my own riding, is that Robin really loved to ride alone. And he used some wonderful phraseology around this. He talked about it being mobile meditation, which I really like, and I think rings true with my own riding. He also said that riding a bike was the closest thing to flying, which I think is another great truism. So just a terrible loss to lose Robin Williams, not only from his work as an entertainer, but to those of us in the cycling community who got to know of him, or many got to know him personally.
Well, the one and only time that I saw him, although I wasn't introduced to him, was he was sort of rushing through one of the Interbike shows in Las Vegas with his little entourage of people following him, just cracking jokes, being funny. But we all knew that he was looking at bikes and that he probably would be buying some more bikes. So,
well, he was, you know, he was very well known in the community because of that. You know, he would show up at Interbike. He showed up at the pro races, and so you know, was very well known to a lot of the pro riders themselves from having interacted with him, and to a lot of the journalists who covered the sport just from having that exposure. So, a terrific loss.
Besides the story you wrote about Robin Williams, and you've written a lot of other stories in 2014, you've been really busy writing for Fat Cyclist. Tell us who Fat Cyclist is. Okay, this is new to me.
If your listeners aren't familiar, I would definitely recommend they go visit this website, fatcyclist.com. It is the brainchild of a guy named Eldon Nelson. Eldon lives in Utah and has been blogging about cycling now for a little bit more than a decade at this site. He is just terrifically funny, but also has done so much good through this website. Has raised over a period of time, I don't know the exact figure, but several million dollars for bike-related charities and cancer-related charities. He is a terrific guy, and so it was very flattering that he asked if I would help to contribute to his most recent book, which is a collection of some of the funnier entries on this Fat Cyclist blog over the years.
And you had something to do with the title of the book? It's hilarious.
I did have to sort of step in, and he went, and this may not be a story well suited to the radio, but he had a draft title in mind that was kind of a very inside reference to a bike injury to a certain part of his anatomy that shall remain unnamed.
And I landed on the top tube, something like that.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So the proposed title of the book, which is the title of the blog entry about this particular injury, was the Lament of the Purple Snipe. And I told him that I would be happy to help with the book, but that was the worst title I had ever heard.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty bad. But you came up with a good title.
We came up with The Great Fatsby.
Which is awesome.
So it was a great experience. He was a really classy guy and a great friend. And I don't know how long we'll be friends. I guess I can reveal this to you, Diary. One of the things, if you've never written five pages of somebody else's book, I highly recommend it. It's definitely the way to go about writing a book, because you get your name on the cover, but you do about 1% of the work. I did have a chance. He sent me some books that people had asked that we get together and scribe, and so had a chance to do some signing of that book as well. But he spent so much. He took up so much of the kind of title page, signing his own inscriptions, that in several of these books, I just sort of found random places in the book. And told people that if they had made it to that page, they were the grand prize winner, and they needed to contact Eldon for their new bike, and that they could pick anyone in his garage.
Oh, awesome. So, I'm sure he's going to really like that.
So I'm not sure if he's learned of that yet, but it could be the end of our relationship.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan Worry. He's down in South Carolina. We're going to wrap up the 2015 season, and we're going to talk next about the Grand Tours. There were some highlights and lowlights. Yeah. What stood out for you?
Well, you know, maybe we take each of them in order. You know, the Giro, you know, my big memory of the Giro, or the takeaway, I think, from the Giro d'Italia is the emergence of Nairo Quintana, of the Movistar team. He is a young guy from Colombia. Was, you may recall, placed very highly in last year's Tour de France, wore the white jersey of the best young rider. He did not compete in the Tour de France in 2014 to focus on the Giro d'Italia, which he won. And so, you know, immediately kind of comes on the scene and emerges as one of the top threats in the Grand Tours, and sort of catapults himself right up into the upper echelon there with Froome and Contador and Nibali. So definitely someone to watch there from the Giro. I have to say, and I wrote about this in Velo, I really found the Tour a disappointment this year. I think in part because there was so much build up to the, you know, I was so looking forward to the tour. It was going to be this first opportunity to really get all of these guys to go head to head. And, you know, it's a part of the sport that we, you know, we lose people to injury, but boy, did we lose a lot of people to injury during the 2014 tour. You know, and in fairly short order after the first several days of the tour, you know, we lost Chris Froome, the defending champion. We lost Alberto Contador, who was, you know, thought to be kind of his primary challenger. Andrew Talansky of the Garmin team, you know, had to bow out due to injury as well. And so Astana's Vincenzo Nibali won the tour very convincingly, but with a weakened field, and so it was kind of a disappointment. And then, you know, I know maybe later we'll talk about some of the other disappointments related to Astana, but that was a disappointment.
Yeah, Astana is another story, isn't it?
Yeah, and maybe that's I guess we can say that at the Vuelta in August, we kind of had the Tour de France. Then Contador was back, Froome was back. We had that head to head showdown. And so to me, from kind of an interest perspective, at least in terms of seeing the big guns really fight it out, the Vuelta was the race to watch this year. And Alberto Contador, as you may recall, took the top step there.
You mentioned that the Vuelta was more interesting and probably more exciting than the Tour. Do you see that maybe the Tour is going to settle in? Everybody loves the Giro. Everybody loves the Vuelta. Everybody loves the Tour. But do you think that they can become a little more equal now? Or is it always going to be Tour de France?
Well, you know, they're all exciting, and they are all prestigious in their own way. And it's actually, I think, great that you know, we've had some really exciting Giros here over the past couple of years. I think the Vuelta sometimes gets short thrift because, you know, it's the Giro and the Tour tend to be so much a focus for some of the top riders. And so it got a real boost this year by having some of the really big names there to duke it out. So I think it's good for all of the Grand Tours that that things sort of panned out the way they did this year. That said, I still think, you know, the Tour de France is the Tour de France. It was disappointing to me personally this year just because we lost the opportunity to see some of those big names go head-to-head, but they'll be back next year.
I want to talk about a couple of specific riders. One who comes to mind right away is Dr. Eric Marcotte. And then, of course, there's Marion Voss. They're two separate things. But those two riders, I have a kind of an interest in them. I talked to Dr. Marcotte, Eric, after he won the U.S. title, national title. And he seems to be very focused on moving up. He's an interesting character.
He really is. Where Robin Williams was maybe one of the saddest stories of 2014. One of my very favorite stories of 2014 was Eric Marcotte's win in Chattanooga at the U.S. Pro Road Championships, and I was there to be able to witness that and cover that a bit. Just a fascinating story. I know we talked a little bit about him last time I was on the show. He is, you know, listeners and maybe if they heard his interview know, this is a guy who has a full-time job. He is a chiropractor in Arizona.
Right.
And so this is, you know, a man who has managed to hold down not only a very demanding career, but is incredibly focused on his own wellness and performance as an athlete, and was really, I think, underestimated at the U.S. Pros. And in part, that may have contributed to how he managed to be overlooked a little bit and helped contribute to that win. But, boy, his team, SmartStop, Michael Creed is the director of that team and has put that together. That team was focused on criterium racing a year ago. And Creed, you know, I don't know, Diane, if you ever saw the movie Moneyball, but I think very much about that team in that way, that, you know, Michael Creed, who was racing himself, was able to retire from a racing perspective and take on director responsibilities at SmartStop and really select the guys that he knew he could put together a winning team. And boy, they had a big, big first year competing in road races. I think they're going to be one of the stories to watch for next year.
I totally agree. And Marion Voss, anybody ever going to beat her?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned, because I actually wouldn't have necessarily picked her as one of the top riders this year. It's funny. I mean, and let me preface that before I get in trouble. You always pick Marianne DeVos as a top rider. She is a multi-time world champion and winner of, I mean, just one of the most dominating riders the sport has ever seen. The interesting thing about her this year is actually this emerging competition, though, with one of her own teammates. You may be familiar with Pauline Ferrand-Prévot. Is one of her teammates on the Rabobank women's team who actually beat Marianne DeVos this year in the road championships, and so is now the new world champion on the road. She was the national road race champion in France, won the national time trial championship. She is the national cross champion in France. She won the women's Flèche Wallonne this year, and so we actually at Dello recognized her here just a month ago as the International Cyclist of the Year across all disciplines, across both genders, because of her incredible performance, which I think really outshone her teammate Marianne DeVos this year. And so it's interesting. I was reading that she did an interview in the French daily Le Peuple here last week, where she kind of hinted that there is a growing rivalry here, and now the kind of awkwardness of showing up at the Rabo women's team camp wearing the world champion's jersey, and there's Marianne DeVos, wearing her regular team kit. So, to me, that's going to be another one of the stories to watch in 2015 is the emergence of Ferrand-Prévot. And whether that relationship with Marianne DeVos holds and how that rivalry will emerge.
Yeah, I think women's cycling is beginning to really shine. I'm going to get to that in a minute, but let's talk for a moment about Tinkoff Saxo.
Tinkoff Saxo. You know,
I guess we have to talk about the ruble.
Yeah, and the ruble. Yes, and welcome to Meet the Press. We'll talk about that. So first off, I have to tell you about Tinkoff Saxo. When Oleg Tinkoff, who is the Russian billionaire who is behind that team, kind of first emerged, I've written several times about him. His Twitter account is so outrageous and was so outrageous at the time that I couldn't even get anyone to confirm that it was actually a legitimate account. People thought it was a parody account. And so, I contacted the team. I contacted other journalists who had some exposure to the team at that time over in Europe. And they either wouldn't respond or they kind of blew me off and said, "Oh no, that's a fake account. Don't pay attention to that." Tinkoff is just such a character, but I've really come to like and admire him in a way, in that he is really shaking things up, I think, within the sport and has the ability to do that. Now, your question, I think, relates to maybe the stability of that team and where they're going. There has been some difficulty. Tinkoff is sort of a credit card and a banking magnate in Russia, and so his personal fortunes are very much tied to the well-being of the Russian economy, which right now is not at all good, in part because of the sanctions that have been imposed by the West based on Russia's approach to Ukraine. And so the value of the ruble has dropped very, very substantially, which has been put a real blow to Tinkoff Bank and to Oleg's personal fortunes, if we understand correctly. And so he gave an interview last week where he said that if these sanctions continued, if the value of the ruble continued to fall, that there might come a time where he might not be able to continue supporting the team. I think, frankly, I think he was trying to just draw attention to the issue of the sanctions more than this is a real legitimate threat. Tinkoff loves cycling, and so I don't see him going away. But if his personal fortunes decline to the extent that he's not able to put up the backing for the team, I think that's what he was talking about. Would hope for his sake that's not going to be the case, and I'd hope for the sport's sake. He's outrageous, to be sure, but has definitely added some fresh air.
He did. He's humorous at the very least, and we all need a little levity.
There's never a dull moment.
Never a dull moment.
If you haven't checked out his Twitter account, have at it and don't say I didn't warn you.
Exactly. Once again, I'm speaking with Dan Worry. We're wrapping up 2014. We're going to get on towards 2015 here. You know, everybody thinks about pro cycling as a European or continental kind of sport, but I think we should be paying attention to some of the things that are going to be happening in 2015 in the U.S. We have some big races in this country.
I tell you what, not only do we have some big races, but we have some very big talent that will be riding for our American teams this year. And so I think I think you're absolutely right that road racing in America is going to be really something fun to watch this year. Not that it hasn't always been, but I think a couple of things have happened. There has been a little bit of shrinkage within the World Tour Peloton that has resulted in some folks coming back from the World Tour back to the continental level. And so, for example, Phil Guymon, who raced for Garmin this year, has signed with Optum for the coming year. And I know, knowing Phil and working with him a bit, he is also a columnist at Bello. He worked so hard to get up to that World Tour level. I think really had great success there in his first year at Garmin. It's a shame that they couldn't keep him on. You might know, consolidated with the Cannondale team, so had some difficulty with riders that were kind of under contract at both. That squeezed a couple of guys out, Garmin included, and so he'll be racing more domestically this year as part of the Optum team. The other big name that we haven't discussed yet is Chris Horner, who won the Vuelta a year ago and had an injury prone 2014, did not get picked back up in the World Tour, but is coming back to America as part of an up and coming team, Airgas Safeway. And so Chris Horner will be racing domestically here, and I think that'll be something to watch, and frankly will bring some excitement to some of those races. And then we already mentioned Michael Creed's team Smart Stop, which I think really has something to prove and is looking to move up themselves. And so the combination of even just those three teams going at it, that's not to mention, many other great domestic teams and riders, but it's going to be really something to watch this year.
I totally agree. And now it's exciting to see some new sponsorship coming on, too. That's,
definitely,
something that we, a couple of years ago, not even, we started to see some drop off in support for cycling because of the doping situation. That seems to have quieted down, which is a good thing. I don't even want to talk about that. But
yeah, I don't know how much it's quieted down, but
well, it certainly isn't a Lance Armstrong in the news every day situation anymore, which it was for a while there.
That's true. Although in Europe, it's still very much the talk. With the Astana team having as many problems as they have.
Every 5 days, somebody else gets popped. That's true.
Yeah, that's it. That's been a real frustration, I think, for a lot of people. I think there was so much hype and to do about USADA's recent decision in the Armstrong case that I think maybe led people to think that doping was more a thing of the past than maybe really, in fact, it is. That's not to say, I do believe fully, Diane, that the sport is much cleaner than it has probably ever been, but probably naive to think that we have put an end to doping once and for all, as evidenced now by these five different positive tests here over the past couple of months linked to the Astana team. It has also put kind of a sour taste on the Tour de France for this year. To have one of the riders, certainly not Vincenzo Nibali himself, but one of the riders who rode into Paris on his behalf test positive for EPO here in the past couple of months is really pretty alarming.
I know this is sort of an extreme position, but I'm wondering why, after you have five riders popped like that, they gave them a license. It's like, clean up your act or we're not going to give you a license. But that obviously is not going to happen.
Well, that's funny. It's actually the topic of my next column in Bello, which I've written as sort of an open letter to Brian Cookson, who is now the president of the UCI. The UCI has historically had difficulty denying a license based purely on ethical reasons, and there are some mitigating factors here with Astana that, in their defense, two of these five were on the World Tour team. Three of those were on the Astana Continental team, which is technically a separate entity, but there's a lot of shared, at least one of the three on the Continental team, for example, rode as a stagiaire for the World Tour team. So there's more overlap there than I think sometimes the team really wants to get into. But it's very troubling to see that many positives in such a short period of time. It's disheartening.
It is disheartening. Well, the last thing I want to talk about is near and dear to my heart, and that's women in cycling. So we spoke with Catherine Bertin recently about her documentary, Half the Sky. How did you see women's cycling as a whole fare in 2014? And do you see a real expansion of women's cycling and some parity in terms of money and sponsorship going forward?
You know, I absolutely see huge growth in women's cycling over the past couple of years, due in part, certainly not exclusively, but in large part to Catherine Bertin, who has been such a force of nature. I've written a little bit about her as well, but boy, she has really been tenacious about highlighting the issues of equity in women's cycling. I don't know that we're at a place where we're going to see kind of a full equity in terms of earnings and race days and so on, but some really substantial improvement here on the horizon. You know, for the past couple of years, the U.S. Pro Championships have offered equal prize winnings. We've got really big expansion. I mean, if you want to talk about an exciting story from 2014, the inclusion of a women's race as part of the Tour de France with Catherine, which Catherine and her colleagues had an awful lot to do with the course by the tour, was a big day for women cycling in 2014. And already on the horizon now, we've got races, many of them here in the United States, the Amgen Tour of California, the USA Pro Challenge from Colorado, the Tour of Utah, all talking about adding women's races as part of those events. And so I see very big things emerging for women's cycling.
I cannot believe that our time is up. I mean, we could just talk all day. I would love to talk with you, and we will talk again. We're going to talk about the great FATSB in the future, and we're going to talk about cycling going forward in 2015. So I'm putting you on notice that I'm going to call you again.
Anytime.
All right. Well, you have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you so much for talking with me on the show today. And watch out for that teenage driver in your house.
That's a whole different part of 2015. Happy New Year, Dan.
Happy New Year, Dan. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Dan Worry joined me from his home in South Carolina talking about cycling in 2014 and 15. We need to take a break. We will be right back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, and we do not have time for news. We are going to head right on over to Brooklyn, New York, and speak with the iconic and legendary Ben Cerotta. Ben, thank you for joining me on the show this evening. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year. And it's an honor to be first up on the new year.
Well, you know, you were my very first interview when I started the show in 2010.
Wow.
Do you remember my coming to your office and sitting in a room and we just kind of chatted?
I do.
Because I happened to be
remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Long time ago. It seems like it wasn't that long, but I guess it was. So let's talk about your impact on the custom frame building world, your opinions and ideas. You know, people have so much respect for what you started. My very first nice frame in my first shop was a Cerata. So that's where I want to go. Tell me about your perspective on the industry and just, you know, back us into today.
Well, it's interesting. As you may know, I have an ability to have a clearer perspective on things today than maybe I did a couple years ago, because I'm a little bit outside of the world that I was in for all those years. And this is really just from my personal perspective. Of course, you know, what motivates frame builders is not always the same thing. And my focus, my motivation was always in, most of all, I'm trying to build bikes that enable people to go faster. And so race bikes was what I was passionate about. I enjoyed building almost every kind of bike that somebody needed, because we built touring bikes and a variety of other types of bicycles. But racing bikes was really the mainstay of my business for most of its time. And back in the 70s and 80s and even well into the 90s, if a competitive rider wanted the best possible equipment, it was kind of automatic that it was going to be custom made, so that it would fit and handle and perform, you know, optimally. And that's probably the thing that ultimately became one of the greater obstacles, is that early on, I think cyclists understood that what they needed was special equipment to go fast. And with the popularity of cycling growing, and with the strength and marketing power of the major brands like Specialized and Trek and Cannondale growing, that general concept that from a consumer perspective, that if I want to take the sport seriously and go faster, I really need a custom bike, that completely went away for two reasons. One is the quality of off-the-shelf equipment genuinely became better. The understanding of bike fit, infiltrated so that bicycles were being manufactured to a higher quality standard. They were being designed to fit people better off the shelf than they were before, and generally offering more sizes. And then on top of that, there was a huge messaging push from bike companies into dealerships that not only is custom not necessary, but custom is dangerous for a consumer because you don't know what you're buying until after you've already paid for it, and blah, 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 blah. And so that my generation of custom builders really was challenged in a new way, in that public perception, you know, really was changed.
Those are really interesting points, but I want to get back to fit for a second, because of you, I became a bicycle fitter, and that was pretty much the direction my business took. And instead of getting bigger and bigger and bigger as a bike shop, we got smaller and smaller and smaller and began focusing more and more on custom only. Today, you're right. You know, people have a lot of very sophisticated fitting type tools like Retool. And of course, you have your institute. The institute is out there because of you, the Fitting and Scientific Institute. But the truth is that the people who are riding today and who are buying custom bikes today are not necessarily racing.
That's very true. I mean, there are quite a few people who may dabble, may try a time trial, or they'll do a cycling, they'll do some triathlon that has a cycling leg in it, or a duathlon, or are they just, but the growth in participation has not been in competitive cycling as a main course. I think the good news is that more people seem to be riding bicycles than ever before, And it doesn't seem to be so much a fad as a new normal, which is fabulous for people who think that cycling is a good thing. And I'm one of those folks.
NABS changed things too, the North American Handmade Bicycle Show. So suddenly there's this much larger, even though we still might call it a cottage industry, this much larger focus on custom bikes again. So, you know, I'm not sure which way it's really going.
If the custom frame builder category is, I don't think it knows where it's going, which is, I think NABS did a wonderful thing by shining a flashlight on people who are working hard at making a living, or at least some of the people working hard at making a living doing one-off bicycles. Talking to a number of custom builders, staying in touch with a number of custom builders, I don't think that market is necessarily growing particularly, and it's becoming more diffuse. So it's my perception is that there are a lot of builders who, not all, but there are a lot of builders who they perceive their job is to build anything that anybody wants to have made without preference. So there are builders, and I think I put myself in that category, and somebody like Richard Sachs is in that category, and certainly there are others who are trying to their brand identity, their product identity fits within a certain framework, and they'll be the best that they can possibly be at that limited product range, and are comfortable saying no to things that fall outside of their area of expertise, experience, or they just don't think are particularly great ideas. But I think the majority, at least it's my impression, that the majority of frame builders of today will kind of build whatever product somebody is asking for because they need the work. And so what somebody's asking for becomes their identity rather than what they have this strong core belief in. That might be, that's not a scientific survey. That's just my impression. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just different.
Yes, it is different.
It's just different.
I'm speaking with Ben Serrata. He is in Brooklyn, New York, not Saratoga Springs right now. And we are talking about sort of the life and times of Ben Serrata and about the industry from his perspective. Tell us what you've been doing the last couple of years.
My business, Serrata Competition Bicycles, had a sad ending, but there were many reasons that the company started struggling, which I won't bother going into. But, there are many reasons the company was struggling, and in the end, though, I really needed to do something to get the company out of the doldrums that it was in, and it was sold to a group who let's just say their expertise was not as billed, and nor was their credibility, and ultimately I was forced out of the company, and shortly thereafter the company folded.
So they basically torpedoed it.
Yeah. Yeah, and myself, and that's I think it's yet to be resolved. The brand, people write me all the time, so perhaps this will save some of the emails. People write me all the time asking me what's going on with Serrata, or will I ever have the brand back? And there's a bit of a legal debate. My team believes that we have the rights to the brand, and these other folks still seem to think that they own it, and so I haven't been focused on that battle. It'll work itself out in time, and so in the meantime I've been doing some consulting work, which has actually been a lot of fun. It's nice utilizing all the things that I know and have learned through trial and error and mistakes, and be able to offer some assistance to other companies. And it's also interesting looking at things from a clear perspective, clear meaning not having an emotional, not being emotionally engaged in that business. When you're in the trenches, sort of in the middle of a firefight, and you have a tremendous amount of emotional investment in this business that you're in, your view is not as clear, or decisions that should be simple black and white decisions become very murky. And certainly I can't blame anybody on the outside for all the problems that my company may have had. We had a lot of great years, we had some challenging years, but I know that, you know, your emotional involvement in your own business can interrupt clear and decisive decision making, you know. So as doing consulting work, I haven't had that. Although I found that if I like the company that I'm doing work with, I can't help but become emotionally tied up in it. It's my DNA. You know, I'm either all in or I'm not in at all.
But you only give your best when you're all in.
That's right. And so I think that's fair. And that's kind of the only way it's the only way I can enjoy working is, you know, I love to work. I'm a natural workaholic, but it has to be gratifying. And if I can't feel like I'm making a productive difference, I fired myself from, I think at least two or three consulting jobs, you know, because I reached a point that I didn't think I was able to contribute more for a variety of reasons, you know, in whatever that circumstance was. So, but it's been fun and challenging, and I'm actually doing work in a very different area of cycling right now, which is in urban cycling, bike share cycling, and which those bicycles, you know, it's the polar opposite of the type of bikes that my company built for all those years. So instead of being very light, very custom, and very deliberate to the last detail, these bikes are one size fits all and are built like tanks.
Right.
And because they have to withstand whatever abuse anybody dishes out, plus the elements, plus vandalism, et cetera. So it's, you know, it's a very different field, and yet it's still something I find I quickly became very passionate about, because it's a wonderful thing. People in New York, people are using not just the bike share program bikes, but people are cycling to work. It's amazing transition that's taking place.
It is an amazing transition, and we talk a lot about it on the show, about how important the idea of cyclists and motorists get along to sort of change the energy between motorists and cyclists. So I don't know if you have a perspective on it, but do you see yourself getting involved in advocacy in any way?
It would be on my list, Diane.
Your long list.
It's like, I don't know how much energy I have for bureaucratic
BS
challenges. And yeah. And though, you know, God bless those who have the energy and the skill. It's not just energy, but it's skill and patience. And there are some people who are very good at that. Thankfully, probably not enough people who are very good at it, or have the inclination. And so encouraging people to become involved is terrific. And I would say that I can be involved from the inside and hopefully help move things in a positive direction. But I won't be at the forefront simply because it's something that I don't think I'm very good at.
Play to your strengths, obviously, not to
exactly.
Your weaknesses.
Yeah,
I get it. I get it. Once again, I'm speaking with Ben Cerrotta, and we're going to sort of ask him right now what you see for the future of cycling as the industry. Now, the industry, because you brought up right at the beginning how today's production bicycle. I mean, you can walk into a bike shop and pull a $9,000 bike off of a rack that's already built, which to me is just one of those insane things. If you've got $9,000, why wouldn't you go to Ben Cerrotta and have him build you a bike, or to Rob Vandermark, or to, you know, one of the other big builders in the country? But where do you see the bicycle industry? The dealers are struggling right now. They're struggling with the big box idea of the Amazons and that. And then we have the small builder. We have such a diverse industry. Do you see anything that might pull it all together?
Well, actually, I see it coming farther apart before there's something that seems like a new normal way of doing business. People will always need their bicycles serviced. On the other hand, I think the ship has sailed in terms of convenience. People, especially people who have expendable income, people value, not everyone, people value time and quality of time ahead of everything else. After food on the table and a roof over your head, it comes down to what's the quality of my life, and which is really as it should be. And so I think people in the bike industry are probably need to start spending a little bit more time looking at things from a consumer's perspective. It's not bicycle stores. Many of them are not easy to do business with. It's very confusing. The industry, you think of how many brands there are, and then within the brands, how many models where there's Trek recently launched a new high-end road bike, and instead of being available in one model and 9 or 10 sizes, it's something like 12 different model iterations of the same thing. It's very confusing. There's just a tremendous amount of noise from the industry to consumers. And go online to online catalog stores that sell many different lines and brands, or just leaf through a magazine, or go on company websites, there's a lot of sameness. There's an overwhelming amount of products and across pretty wide price range. The claims of all the things that these products do are about the same, within a line and within a product line, within a brand and across brands. So the industry is doing a very poor job at making it simple and easy to understand, to a consumer what it is that maybe they should want to have just to have a great quality time. And so this industry has always been I think its greatest enemy. We're in our way right now. We're not, the industry is not helping consumers to an easier time, and which is one of the appeals of simplicity. So, bike share bikes, depending what city you're in, they're one color, one size, and they work. And people are discovering that they can enjoy getting from point to point on a no-frills bike. And it's cheap, and so I think the industry, we've seen a lot of the industry are having a negative knee-jerk reaction to bike share programs because they think, we're being put out of business. They don't need us anymore. They have their own systems for taking care of things. The industry needs to look at what consumers are responding positively to. I think there are some answers out there that consumers are telling us. Which is, we like things simple. We want to be able to ride bikes and have a great time. Yeah, I think the industry is going to come apart a little bit more before there's a new normal bit of business.
What a great perspective. I like that. I think that, you can distill it right down to the one thing you said. People want more time. They want to be able to control their time and to spend 10 hours in the bike shop trying to slog through all of the different models and iterations of these bikes. You're absolutely right. Of course, it's all about selling product. We understand that. But I can remember, we would get a bike in and it came in 3 sizes, maybe 4, and that's what we sold. That was 40 years ago, but so what?
Yeah. And, Bike fitting is I don't have any regrets, and I think I feel not singularly responsible, but I feel largely responsible for somewhat opening this Pandora's box on bike fit. And it was, you know, and it's by and large a good thing. But on the other hand, I see now that, well, actually some of the most fun I've had on a bike in the last half dozen years was, you know, on a, you know, I rented a tandem and I went on with my daughter once. It was just a, you know, a cruiser tandem. I rented bikes in other places. Yeah, that looks like it'll be close enough. Fine. And it's sort of where you are and how, you know, it's what you can do with your time that matters the most. Unless you're a very high level, serious competitive athlete, then, and, you know, literally the quality of the quantity of time that it takes to get from point A to point B becomes the thing that matters the most. And then, you know, then you can really justify taking fitting and performance evaluation to the other extreme. Right. And, you know, for most people, it's somewhere in the middle. And I'm not sure what that formula is, but it's not to go to an extreme, and it's not to ignore the importance of a good fitting bike altogether.
The industry has been very blessed with Ben Cerrada and has learned, we've learned a lot. And,
well,
you know,
you.
And many of us. And in fact, I don't think anybody who has been in the industry for any period of time has not been touched by what you do and what you've taught us. So from everybody
well,
out here
very
to
generous.
You. No,
that's
no.
Very generous.
Well,
you.
You know, I mean, I learned a lot by being one of your dealers for a very, very long time. And I really enjoyed every time you and I had an interaction, including this one.
And likewise.
Well, thank you. So I'm just going to wrap it up by saying Happy New Year, and I hope our paths will cross again, and we'll talk again, and I hope you have a wonderful 2015.
Well, thank you, Diane. Thank you very much, and the same back to you, and it's been a pleasure and an honor. Look forward to the next time.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ben Cerrada, the iconic and legendary frame builder who has sort of come full circle and has such an interesting and unique perspective on our industry, joined me from his new home in Brooklyn, New York. I hope you enjoyed our show this evening. I enjoyed speaking to both of our guests, Ben and Dan. I hope you have a wonderful 2015. Every single day that you can, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.